Hello and welcome. You're tuned into the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Remember, today is also True Crime Tuesday. We have a brand new episode up, and this is an amazing episode. Bob Mazur joins me, The Infiltrator. If you haven't seen this movie, it stars Bryan Cranston, John Leguizamo, Benjamin Bratt. There are a myriad of celebrities in this movie, and it is based on the true life of Bob Mazur, our guest, who went deep undercover to deal with ruthless drug cartels and drug lords. It is really just an astounding story, and Bob's going to come on and talk with us about this case. He fills the entire 2 hours of today's episode, so we have a separate addendum for those of you that would like to hear it, of our Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals. So there's actually two podcasts up, the two-hour True Crime Tuesday, and then a 20 to 30-minute version of Dumb Crimes, Stupid Criminals. You can check that out and subscribe by visiting darknessradio.com. That's darknessradio.com. And then click on the True Crime Tuesday banner. We've got a great program in effect right now through September 1st. All of the people that have signed up from the beginning until September 1st are going to be entered in a drawing. We're going to give three lucky listeners a one-year subscription to True Crime Tuesday. So if you subscribe now, or you've already been subscribed, anybody that is subscribed by the time September 1st rolls around, all of those people are put in the mix. Three will be drawn at random, and you will be announced on the radio show and know that you've been the winner of a full one-year subscription. So make sure you sign up now if you haven't already done it. It's a great opportunity to possibly get your subscription for an entire year free, and you'll never miss another minute in the best of True Crime Talk Radio. Again, sign up now by going to darknessradio.com and clicking on the True Crime Tuesday banner. Tonight, our guest is David McAfee. He has written a book called No Sacred Cows, Investigating Myths, Cults, and the Supernatural. And David is the author of numerous books, including Atheist Answers, Rational Responses to Religious Questions, Mom, Dad, I'm an Atheist, The Guide to Coming Out as a Non-Believer, and Disproving Christianity and Other Secular Writings. He lives in Southern California. And in his book, he covers the idea of, while belief in religious supernatural claims is waning throughout the West, evidence suggests that belief in non-religious supernatural claims is on the rise. What explains this contradiction? How can a society with a failing belief in God have a rising belief in ghosts, psychic powers, ancient astronauts, and other supernatural or pseudo-scientific phenomena? Taking the same anthropological approach he employed in his notable studies of religion, atheist author and activist David G. McAfee turns his attention to non-religious faith-based claims. Whether going undercover as a medium, getting tested at Scientology headquarters in Los Angeles, or interviewing celebrity paranormalists and famous skeptics, he leaves no stone unturned in his investigation. He's here this evening with us to share a different perspective on the many topics that we cover right here on the show. David, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. Happy to be here.
Let's start off. One of the things that's really intrigued me is the Scientology aspect. And we were actually going to look into doing a full episode on that a few years ago. And after watching the documentary Going Clear and having mentioned that we wanted to do that, I was contacted by quite a few people that are current Scientologists and former Scientologists who highly recommended that if I wanted to fly low and not have a bunch of really irritating things happen to me, I should probably just leave that topic well enough alone. And that just seemed ridiculous. It was like, I'm not, I do shows on the mob for true crime. I do shows on serial killers, and I don't have the concerns I do worrying about if I should do a show on Scientology. David, what made you decide you wanted to investigate that?
It's really amazing. I actually didn't know a lot about that aspect of their cult until pretty recently. But I decided to investigate Scientology because I came across a video by Jamie DeWolf. He's the great-grandson of L. Ron Hubbard, who is the founder of Scientology. And Jamie just did a really, really amazing job of deconstructing the cult and how it started and his great-grandfather's work. And did it in a funny way. He's a stand-up comedian, so it was amazing. And I interviewed him for the book, and that was kind of my first step into that world. And then I realized that they have an Armageddon bunker about 5 miles from my house. Scientology headquarters has a secret bunker that not many people know about. And so I decided to investigate that recently, and then I got in some hot water with them. They're now emailing me, accusing me of religious discrimination because of my blog post about that, about their Armageddon bunker.
How is that religious discrimination by reporting on an Armageddon bunker?
Well, they're saying that I'm picking on their religion specifically, but if they looked into my work, they would see that I've tackled Islam and Christianity, and as you mentioned, I'm now doing a lot of work with other non-religious supernatural claims. But I wrote up a blog post just describing my experience there. I went hiking around the area. It's in the woods, in the mountains near my house, and so I just took a little walk with my wife, and they have about 300 to 400 visible cameras around the perimeter. They're very, very secretive people. They also had a bunch of used, like old dog kennel things in the back, metal dog crates. I didn't know really what they'd be using those for. It was just a really bizarre, huge bunker. And if you believe the reports about it, they have underground bunkers going for about a mile underneath the mountain, and that John Travolta and Tom Cruise have, secret odds there for when there's a nuclear holocaust.
Well, I'm glad that John and Tom will survive it all, so that we can see more movies from them in the future after the apocalypse settles. What a strange deal. Now, did you actually go in and go through one of their interviewing sessions, and what was that like?
Oh, I did. Yeah, in Los Angeles, I went to their headquarters, and they do free testing there where they give you two tests. One is a personality test, and one they say is an IQ test. And the IQ test, they said that I got one of the highest scores that they've ever seen. And then they said that because of that, because of my IQ, that I'm sad and depressed and lonely, and that I need their services. I need to buy their book. I need to join their agency. And it was just very, very bizarre. The questions they asked were very revealing. For instance, one of them was, do you respond well to authority? And I was like, no, not really. And then the next one was like, if you're told what to do, are you good about doing it? Like, they were just very redundant, but they basically want to see if you're going to be a good cult member.
That is so strange. How do you, you know, again, I'm not here to bash any one certain religion or belief system.
No.
And you know, I mean, it's real easy as a Christian myself to say, oh, this sounds ridiculous. Who would believe in sky gods and aliens? And, you know, and then it can be just as easily turned on its head of, you know, who believes that there's a giant, great omnipresence somewhere in the sky watching over us and using us like a chessboard, and, you know, had sent his half-human, half-god son to our planet to save our lives by being crucified. So I understand the irony of rolling your eyes and questioning the sincerity of other religions. But when there's, mm-hmm. I mean, you're doing this research, people don't go into this completely blind. They have to realize this was a science fiction writer. It would be like Edgar Rice Burroughs starting the church of Tarzan. And everything that you're writing on is based on machinations of your own imagination and has no roots or bearings, at least in a lot of the religions around the world. They're based in these thoughts and belief systems that extend through history, and the principles and desires of humans to follow a lead. Mm-hmm. But in the case of Scientology, it just seems insane. And yet there are some of the most clever, interesting, and famous people in the world that are attached to this. What do you make of that?
It's definitely strange. I'm a religious studies graduate, so I was majoring in comparative religions, and we didn't have a class on Scientology. All of our myths were ancient myths, and it's strange to see one pop up now. As you mentioned, there is a connection between supernatural beliefs of all kinds, and in the book, I'd really try to argue you have to see that connection at very least. You know, you can obviously distinguish between different beliefs, but there is a connection between all supernatural beliefs. And with Scientology specifically, it's just interesting to see this rise so out of the blue and out in the open. In the book, when I interview Jamie DeWolf, he talks about how his great-grandpa was very open about creating a religion for the money. Like he said he was going to do it so that he could make money off of it. And he tried as a psychology substitute at first, and he got shut down for doing it illegally because he couldn't practice medicine and was going against what we taught in psychology. And then he was like, well, what if I turn it into a religion? And they said, well, that would be fine. And then that's what he did. So
talk about crazy laws right there, right? You can't, without a license or an education, psychologically evaluate someone and tell them how to live their lives, because that's wrong. But if I do it under the guise of religion, it's completely open.
It's incredible how that works. But yeah, that's exactly how it works, and that's what happened. And watching it happen today, you do get this sense of disbelief, like, how do these people do it? And then you have to realize that there was one time when Christianity was considered cult. A cult, by definition, is a very small group, a religious group, and it was a cult of second century Judaism, and it was existing in that way for quite some time, and people probably had similar ideas toward them as they do toward Scientologists now, where they said, how could they believe that this guy came back to life, and how could they believe that he turned water into wine? And so it's interesting to kind of put yourself in that perspective and imagine what it would be like in those times to see this cult of Christianity arise.
So I need to know, David, you went through the tests, you have this off-the-charts IQ, and obviously you're depressed and feel lonely because of your hyper-intelligence. Were you a good cult follower? Were you primed for after the evaluation? Or did they tell you, you know what, David, maybe you should look into the Church of Donny Osmond. That might be better for you.
They did make their subtle attempt. Actually, they really just tried to get me to buy this $50 book. That was their main goal. But I was there with another friend of mine who didn't get the same scores, who scored differently on the personality and IQ test, and they made a much more concerted effort to get her to join their cult, to actually come to classes regularly and stuff like that. So I think they were going for the long con with her and just thought that maybe they could get me for $50, but they did not.
They did not. Well, maybe they're just trying to replace Leah Remini, and you weren't fitting the bill.
Oh, man. She's been a very vocal critic, so
yes,
I'm sure they're happy about that.
As a matter of fact, let me mention A&E's Emmy-nominated groundbreaking docuseries, Leah Remini, Scientology and the Aftermath, returns for Season 2 on August 15th. There's 10 all-new episodes, and Leah Remini, Scientology and the Aftermath follows actress Leah Remini, along with her high-level former Scientology executives and church members, as they delve deep into the shocking stories of abuse, heartbreak, and harassment experienced by those who have left the church and spoken publicly about their experiences. This season, Leah Remini continues her quest to give a voice to the victims of the Church of Scientology. And the series also explores accounts of former members whose lives have been significantly impacted by the church's practices. Leah is helping people take action, turning survivors into fighters, revealing truths, and seeking justice. You can watch the first season of Leah Remini, Scientology and the Aftermath online, on demand, and in the A&E app. And then, if you haven't seen it yet, it is a fascinating series. And hearing all of the heartbreak, heartache, and headaches that this group causes for people that pull away, you've got to give this woman credit, because she has taken a position, she is standing her ground, and in Hollywood, it is amazing that with the power players behind Scientology, that she is able to do this. And I applaud both Leah Remini and A&E for looking into this story and exposing the truths that they found in this. So that's fantastic. But check that out on A&E as well. Have you had any, I mean, you got some emails, but I mean, do you feel like there's any issues boiling or lawsuits coming because you've talked about Scientology and maybe shown the light on a few aspects they didn't want people to know?
Well, I'm definitely concerned, and part of my concern is this new book, No Sacred Cows, where I have the interview with Jamie DeWolf, and I have the section called Exposing Scientology, and we go pretty in-depth on that. And that's due out, that hasn't even released to the public. It could be pre-ordered on Amazon, but it comes out August 22nd, and when that does, I'm expecting more from them. But when I walked around the premises of their underground bunker area, there was a distinct feeling that we were being followed. And by that, I mean, there were cars following us directly, and they were all white cars. And every time we turned, they turned, and they would just slowly go behind us as we walked. It was very strange to be followed. We were on public property at that point, you know? And so we left pretty quickly and had some negative experiences there as far as that was concerned. We've had other friends who have just pulled into their parking lot to turn around and had guns pointed at their heads. And
Wait. So yeah. You pull into their parking lot to turn around and the Scientologists are armed?
Yes. Yeah, they have armed guards on the premises. This bunker is more highly guarded. It's not for the public. Like, you would go to the headquarters and they have nice people on bikes and they're friendly, and it's not like that at all.
Oh, this property, this specific property, the Armageddon property. Yeah, well, I understand that. They can't have the dirty likes of David McAfee coming out there and ruining things for them, trying to get into their cans of Spam and SpaghettiOs with sliced Franks.
Exactly. And I actually interviewed a construction worker who worked on the bunker, who told me some of the details inside of it. For instance, that they have Tom Cruise movies playing 24/7 on all the TVs in the entire building, just in every room. They have his movies just on the loop. And that it's a giant tube that leads down to the Armageddon bunkers, and they have big floating water reservoirs for when the end comes, and they have all of L. Ron Hubbard's, all of his writings ever preserved on laser disc, because it was done in the 80s, so that's the technology. It fills up an entire room, but now if they did that, it would all fit on a flash drive, so it's pretty funny.
That is hilarious. Wow. And that they've got Tom Cruise movies showing 24/7. Well, at least we'll be entertained, you know, if we were able to get into that Scientology Armageddon shelter at the last moment. Well, the fascinating aspects about this, when you decided to kind of deconstruct and look at religions, and I know this is a touchy subject and it's going to irritate and piss off some of my listeners and fascinate other listeners, but again, we're not here to please everyone. We're here to try to understand and educate. When you start dealing in the realm of religion, that can piss a lot of people off to the point of violence and actual harm to you in your life and career. Why would you take that stand? What pushed you to that? This is something you wanted to investigate, not once, not twice, but multiple times throughout your books.
Yeah. I have a very passionate curiosity about religion that goes back to when I was 13 years old. And I was always I always loved going to church. It was my favorite thing to do. The songs, the games, we got candy, we learned cool stories. It was like my vacation. I didn't have a great childhood, and I did love church. So that was just my norm. And then when I was 13 and I had to stay home and do homework one Sunday, and my grandma, who's a fundamentalist Christian, told me that I was going to go to hell. And I was like, Grandma, those are just stories we learned. Those are just to help us be good people. That's not all true. And she was like, oh, it's all true. And she told me that she believes the earth is 6,000 years old and women should be subservient to men. And when I found out my grandma really believed all that stuff, when I found out she believed in a literal Adam and Eve and that the God drowned everyone on earth except one family, it didn't drive me away from religion like for a lot of people. And I started investigating it as more of an anthropologist. I started going to church 3 or 4 times a week. And then when I went to college, nobody was surprised that I wanted to major in religious studies. And I wrote my first book pointing out biblical inaccuracies because I wanted to show my grandma that it wasn't a literal foolproof book, that it wasn't completely correct, and that it had falsifications in it.
What were some of the most glaring inaccuracies that you were able to come upon?
The first thing that made me want to write a little bit more about the topic was in the Bible, it says in one spot that human beings can't be more than 80 years old. You can't live longer than 80 years old. And then the flood happens, and then it says you can't live more than 120 years old. So first of all, God's changing laws, and that already confused me a little. And then I looked it up, and there have been people that we know of today that have lived more than 120 years. And that's a law that says it can't happen, and through modern technology, we've already broken that. Everything that it says in the Bible, the crazy stuff, the giants and stuff that we know weren't on Earth. We don't have any bones or fossil records or anything that are in the Bible. Basically, with Disproving Christianity, I just compiled a list of inaccuracies within the text. Like, here it says God does this. Here it says God can't do that. Like, God can do anything. But then it says that even with God on his side, that certain people couldn't win certain wars. And so it's just very contradictory, and I felt I needed to compile a list of those.
Did that have any effect on your grandmother's system of beliefs once you were able to present her with that type of information?
It did not at all. No, she was always still proud of me and loved me, but she maintained her belief 100%. I do, however, my mom has since then, since my writings, has now, she identifies as an atheist, as a non-believer, as a skeptic. And my dad has actually gone the other way. He is now Mormon. He just got baptized into the Mormon church about a couple months ago. So it's kind of interesting.
So what do you make of that, to jump from one religious set of beliefs to another, even though you've you know, kind of set out these stories? Is the main line of contention when you come forward with that as, well, this is the work of the devil, you trying to debunk this, this is the devil's information that he's put out to try to dissuade people or make them question the system of beliefs regarding God?
I've definitely heard that a lot. But for most people, I find that when they don't take criticisms seriously and lose their faith over time, that it's not really about belief so much for them. Like, for my dad, I don't see him, I don't think he really, I don't know necessarily if he believes the Joseph Smith stories, or he found a golden tablet with that he had to translate, but only he could translate it. I don't think he believes in all that stuff, but he really likes the community and he enjoys the people there. And I think that for a lot of people, that's what religion is. It's not really about what you believe. It's about what you hope. It's about who you associate with. And it's more of a cultural aspect for those people.
For those people. What do you mean by that, David McAfee?
I call them cultural Christians in my book, but it could be cultural Muslims or cultural Mormons or whatever it is.
This is an interesting kind of dichotomy, because we will do shows about ghosts, Bigfoot, fairies, aliens, reincarnation, near-death experiences. But if I do a show with a heavy religious slant, the same people that tune into all those other shows are offended, irritated, want nothing to do with the religious theology of it, don't want Christianity being pushed down their throat regarding these stories. And you kind of tackle that with the book too, that how are we at this point where the God version of our history seems to be slipping away, and the supernatural around that, but yet the rest of these things are rising up? I mean, it does seem like they would go hand in hand with one another, as opposed to one getting more powerful as the other slips.
Exactly. That's my main question in all this. And I think the answer might be the reasons for why people believe. So if people were becoming more evidence-based thinking, if they were becoming scientific skeptics, which is what I consider myself, there aren't very many of us, but we're people who form our beliefs only after seeing demonstrable scientific results. So if something can't be proven scientifically, I will just abstain from believing, and it's an interesting question, I'm not sure, you know? And if we're trending toward this, you'd see a decline in supernatural beliefs of all kinds, in superstitions, in ghosts, in gods, in everything. But that's not the case. I think people are switching out one set of beliefs for the other, and the main difference is dogma is links to outdated doctrines of moral codes. I think people are trending away from those. They don't want their moral code written in stone in the Bronze Age so that it can never be changed, and so that it leaves out things like the Ten Commandments, for instance, that leaves out things like rape and slavery and says, like, don't covet your neighbor's donkey and worship God appropriately. And so people are trending away from those types of rigid doctrines and more towards spirituality and unproven but spiritually fulfilling beliefs.
We need to take a break. We've got a lot more to cover. The book is called No Sacred Cows, Investigating Myths, Cults, and the Supernatural. David McAfee, our guest.
Beyond Darkness.
Hello, welcome back. This is the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. And we love to look into different aspects of all of the claims and stories that we hear. As you know from the years I've been doing the show, I'm a skeptical believer. I've seen things I cannot discount. I've had experiences I can't say were normal. And I've tried to search for the answers. I've tried to understand what it was I saw, what I experienced, and how I experienced it. And even though there are things that are deeply ingrained in my memory and in images and things that I've seen, I still continue to question, which I think is an important part of this field. If you're interested in the supernatural and paranormal, I don't think you should ever be satisfied with just the experience. You should try to understand, A, why you had the experience, what may have caused the experience. And I think that that's a big part of what continues my drive in this field. Our show has always been set up to educate, enlighten, and entertain people. And that's why we have David McAfee with us tonight. No Sacred Cows is the name of the book, Investigating Myths, Cults, and the Supernatural. Looking at it from a skeptic point of view and investigating these claims, we've talked a little bit about kind of the cult and religious aspects in the beginning of the show here. Let's start looking at some more of the supernatural. And how did you really put yourself in the field to try to understand this? You said in the press release that you actually went undercover as a medium or a psychic. Tell me a little bit about that experience for you.
Oh, that was a lot of fun. So for my psychic chapter, I decided I wanted to go see some psychics. I've never been to a reading. And so I wanted to go firsthand and do that. And I did two readings, and then I ended up interviewing three psychics, and those transcripts are in the book. And one of them is a celebrity psychic who has worked for Ellen DeGeneres and Eva Longoria and stuff. So I got my experience there, and after witnessing how they all did it, I adopted my own pseudonym. My name was Suro the Seer. Suro backwards is Horus, so I took a kind of ancient Egyptian bent there. And I went to Venice Beach and I just started doing readings. I started doing exactly what I had learned, cold readings, hot readings, visual cues. I used tarot cards and I had a really high success rate. I mean, people were impressed. People were happy. I had this one, all my readings were free. I would not take any money from them, from these people. But one woman was just insisting that I take her money. She was like, I can't cause you to lose this spiritual energy and not be repaid somehow. And I'm like, no, it's free, no big deal, it's fine. And she's like, no, you worked so hard, and I know that the psychic realm demands that of you. And I could tell she'd been ripped off in the past, and I could tell that she really wanted to give me money, but I wouldn't take it.
The idea that life continues once we leave the physical plane, I know people want to believe that there's something. I want to believe that there's something beyond this. And speaking to mediums and soothsayers and oracles, I understand the want and desire to make that connection. You know, we just had a Remembrance Day for my mother who passed away in November. Her birthday was on Sunday. She would have been 71 years old. And I've walked a very interesting line as somebody who's been fascinated with the paranormal and was raised by a woman who was fascinated with the paranormal, who made the pledge that, of course, I will be in touch with you after my passing. I'll be there and we'll communicate. And we talked about that days before her passing. It's been 9 months since her passing, and I cannot say that I definitively have anything that I would connect to being a spiritual encounter with my mom. Not a dream visitation, not a sign. And I'm a harder guy to get to because I don't believe that, oh, I saw a wheat penny and my grandfather and I used to collect wheat pennies, so this must be a sign for my grandfather. I don't buy into those kind of aspects of it. And I know that comforts some people, and if that's what they need, I'm all for it. But it has challenged my paradigm. And I hear, wow. I hear people that are mediums and psychics that, you know, I've talked to since the passing of my mom, and they've offered readings, and I've politely declined because most of them knew my mom, and I just feel that would be hard for me to differentiate as a skeptical believer what they think they know and what would really be a message for my mom. And
of course,
and because I'm still in that grieving process myself, I've really tried to hold off from having a connection made for me for fear that I will force a star shape into a triangle hole just to feel like I've got some kind of connection. So that has really started to make me question a lot of the aspects I've always believed in when it comes to ghosts and communication. But on the other side, I've seen and I've been there myself and have heard amazing readings with mediums and psychics that I've worked with, and not generalizations, but deeply detailed and concise information that has blown me away as well as the audience, because you hear a lot of the generalizations made and, oh, you have an older male in your family with a J name. Well, we all seem to have, right? A Jerry, Jim, John, Joe, you know, any of those that seem to pop up. So I understand the skepticism to that, but when they start pulling out specifics of, you know, details about that person's physicality or how they died, something that recently has happened to this person in their life that they haven't put up on social media that, you know, would not be something that they're alerted to. What do you make of those moments? The as we call them, the holy shit moments when it comes to the paranormal.
Of course, yeah. So first of all, I just want to say that it's really refreshing to speak with a skeptical believer, somebody who's not willing to just jump to any conclusion as supernatural, because that's mostly who I interact with when I'm online and I do debates and stuff like that. So I appreciate that. Also, I want to make note of the fact that in the ghost chapter of the book, I discuss what are called grief hallucinations. And they're actually really, really common, more common than you'd think. And you might even experience this. You mentioned you're still in the grieving process, but you might get a visual hallucination of your mother because of these emotions, because of it's basically a defense mechanism against grief from our brain. And I talk about it pretty in depth in the book. But if you do experience that, even if you had this experience, you'd probably, that might be what you need for your supernatural conclusion, but I would still say that's most likely a grief hallucination because they're well documented. But I am hoping for something in that regard, something to give you some sort of a positive feeling, because I would want a grief hallucination, even though I know it's a hallucination, you know, just because I like that. As far as these holy shit moments, there are a lot of interesting examples, but I think most of them are either luck, as in coincidence, or fraud. And the best example of fraud is Peter Popoff. I don't know if you've heard of him.
Right.
But he was he's a faith healer and a psychic, and he would go on stage and just rattle off these very specific things about these people. And it turns out that he had the room bugged, and he was hearing all of their conversations, and what do people talk about when they're in the room of a faith healer, of a person who's supposed to read their mind, is the exact things that are on their mind. So it works really well that way. I also, as you mentioned, social media is a huge thing for a lot of psychics. So stuff that could be hidden way back in a comment of a picture from 10 years ago, you might not think about, but I personally did that when I was a psychic. When I was pretending to be a psychic, I looked back as far as I could to find out any small details. And those things turned out to be quite significant when said at the appropriate time.
That I understand. And I understand how the game can be played. I've had the luxury, and perhaps in the future we can work together on something like this. I've had the luxury of running events for years where I host paranormal conferences around the United States. And I set the parameters. I set the room. And I know that there's no bug devices. I know that there's nothing, because I've gone in and I've set it up, and I've been the one to usher the mediums into the room and kind of MC or host the gallery sessions that they've had. And to me, it's funny. You know, there have been cases with Michael and Marty Perry are two of the most gifted, in my opinion, of the people that are mediums and psychics, because I've seen them and witnessed them say and do things that there's just, I cannot logically wrap my head around. And
are you familiar with James Randi's Paranormal Challenge?
Yes, I'm very aware of James Randi. We've had him on the show a few times, and he's a fascinating guy. And, you know, but he's also a carnival barker, a self-proclaimed carnival barker, in the sense that he knows what business and showmanship is as well. And it's a way to remain relevant and put in there. But I've watched Michael and Marty Perry enter a room, do a gallery session where we've got 200 people in the audience, and they're going through and picking out really distinguishing issues about people throughout the audience without, in many cases, they're not prepaid. It's not like they got an email saying, yes, we'll be attending. Here's my $25. Here's my name and my credit card. They don't know who's in attendance to these events, because I hold all the records. I hold all that back. Because, and I've told them up front, I'm not going to give any information. They've been, to their credit, have said, I don't want any information. I don't need this. And
I've never heard of these people. I do want to learn more. This sounds interesting. I would be interested in seeing for myself.
Right. And that's the aspect of it that really astonishes me. And I've seen, like, with them, and I understand where you're going, talking about the fact that, you know, a lot of things are generalized. We're probably one of the most, and coming back to my mom, probably one of the most compelling issues I ever saw with this. And I'm very skeptical. And I told my mom, we're going to go get a reading from Michael and Marty Perry. My mom wanted to connect with my grandfather. And I gave them no information about my grandfather. I didn't tell them a thing about them, about my grandfather. And he had been gone for 15, 20 years already. And I brought my mom and I said, don't give them anything. She goes, what do you mean? I said, when they give a little nugget, don't flesh out the story so that he can attach to that story and make it seem like he came up with it. And which I know it's a common trick. And I sat there and I watched, and it is fascinating. I've seen bad mediums and I that are really proficient at reading somebody, hearing you say something, stating it back to you, and making you believe he's the one that just told you first. And I've seen people do that. Michael and Marty had a different air about them in the way they do this. As a matter of fact, Michael started to take on the physicality of my grandfather, some of his quirks and tics and things that my grandfather would do, from the way he sat to the way he started fidgeting with his ring. And I've known the guy for years. I've never seen him do this. He started fidgeting with his ring, his wedding ring, and playing, kind of rubbing his knuckle. And that was exactly what my grandfather would sit there in the same position. And I had to point it out to my mom. I'm like, look at him. She's like, what? And I said, look at him. Look at the way he's moving. And she was blown away. And then he went into this reading for my mom. And again, some of it's generalized. Yeah, your father loves you. He's very proud of the choices you made, blah, 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 blah. And then he started to get into the deeper, weirder realm. And one of the things, you know, we do a true crime show as well. One of the things that has compelled me in that was my own loss through a true crime. And it was a brutal, violent, true crime. But I never spoke about it. And especially up to that point in my life, it was never public. I didn't put it out there. And I have seven children. He connected. He said, oh, I'm seeing a baby and I'm seeing like a cut, and starts talking. He said it was something like, it's a home. I see it being like a home birth. And my oldest son, who was named after my grandfather, was a home birth. And yeah, I'm like, oh, that's, yeah, this and that. That was kind of fascinating. He goes, no, this is different. Now, that was what compelled me. He could have easily just said, yeah, yeah, that's exactly what I meant. Obviously, yeah. It's a good tie. We're talking about your grandfather, and he's referring to the baby born at home that was named after him. That would have been a natural deal. What impressed me was he said, no, this is different. He goes, and he starts drawing an imaginary line up his stomach. He goes, I feel a cut. And then he taps the back of his head and he goes, and I feel like an impact, like something hitting in the back of the head. And he goes, does this make sense to you? And I just sat there, and again, not wanting to give too much and not sure where this is going, I slowly kind of nodded, and my mom's mouth dropped open, which I, again, you know, you're giving nonverbal clues. Yes. But he's getting specific into this. He goes, this was an unnatural childbirth. This was, and my girlfriend, my very first girlfriend from high school, of course, we weren't together at this time, but we had remained close, had been murdered while she was pregnant. And it was this crazy scheme concocted by these three people. And again, there's no reference of this anywhere online. There was nothing for them to tie this to or know about me. My name appeared in no articles, nothing like that. But she had been shot in the head, and then they cut her open to remove the baby and stole the baby.
Wow.
And for me, that was above. Yeah. You have an old, I have an older man in here, like a father or a grandfather. Does this make sense? You know, you're not getting the generic. This was specific to this. And he said, he points out and he goes, she's really worried and concerned about you because of this, and that you're carrying this, you feel guilt and remorse over this. And again, I hadn't confirmed to him who this was or why. And I did for many years. I carried so much guilt over this woman's death, because I felt there was things I could have done or helped her out of her situation so that she would not have ended up this way. So those are the moments that I said, you know, I'm a skeptical believer. And even though I saw that, I still question, how is that possible? How could they know that?
Yeah.
And the randomness of it and the detail of it, that's what really, you know, that's what keeps me fascinated by this field, that people like that can do that. And here's the deal. If they miraculously somehow were able to find something somewhere, that to me is even more impressive, because it's something that's not public.
Yep. That's really impressive. I will note that with the starting off general like that, like something like this, I feel this, it just seems to me like if it is real and mediums are real, the way in which they communicate with the dead is the strangest thing in the world. Like, they could have said, your ex-girlfriend says this instead. I feel something about a stomach. Like, why would the dead communicate in such a vague and generalized way? It's just beyond me. But it's certainly fascinating, but it also plays into the aspect that it's probably not real, because when you start general like that, they can read small, even micro expressions in your eye. If it's a really good medium, they can tell exactly if they're going in the right direction. They can tell if they want to delve deeper into something. And I could think of things in my life that I would have connected those same clues to. And I'll just also tell one story about when I was being a psychic. This woman came to me. I knew nothing about her. I didn't know anything. I hadn't researched her or anything, which is part of what I did in a lot of them, but I didn't with this one. And she looked like, to me, like she could have been in the early stages of pregnancy, but I wasn't sure, but that was just a feeling I got. And so I went with that. And I said, out of nowhere, it just came out of my mouth. I said, you should be, the spirits are telling you to be safer, that you'll be better off this time than with T, the letter T. I don't know where I got the letter T. It just was something I said. And this woman just burst into tears, because she had had a miscarriage with a boy named Tommy before her current pregnancy. And this woman was hysterical, and I felt terrible, and I felt like I helped her at the same time. But it was a really conflicting experience that I talk about in the book because of that. And it reminded me of that instance because of this reaction that it was just so emotional, and like I hit the nail right on the head, everything she was concerned about all in one, and without any prior information, starting with just vague generalities.
But in that sense, let's explore that if you don't mind. Let me be the skeptic of your story.
Okay.
As I said, my paradigm and my thoughts have shifted a lot on the belief of what they are connecting with. And like you, my question is always, why so many games? Why holding out a red rose? Why, you know, showing the line on the stomach? And I often wonder, all right, science cannot pinpoint where consciousness exists in our form. Right? They have you found any place? I mean, they talk about it being the brain.
People acknowledge that it's in the brain because when you get a brain injury, all of you can go away. You can become an entirely different person. You can lose every thought, every imagination. You could become a vegetable. You can lose all of that when you sever the brain. So I think it's pretty conclusive that it's within there, but I think science is unsettled in terms of where.
Right, but the idea of consciousness being greater than just a chemical reaction or a neural net pathway, and yes, you're right, you can sever or damage and have that wave away, but does that energy, does the energetic pattern around us contain these memories? Are some people just more adept, like a radio tuner, to pick up on these memories and reflections? I mean, you got this impression early pregnancy, the tea, as you said, you have no idea where this information came from. You're trying to translate the information to make it work to try. You weren't trying to be a bad medium. You weren't trying to go way off base and say, hey, I see you having sex with a pony. You know, I mean, you weren't doing things that would be inflammatory or trying, right? You were trying to give them an actual reading. In that sense, then, how do you know that you weren't going out? It's because you weren't focused on your ego or id, you were focused on the person at hand. How do you know that you weren't making a connection to their memories, to their consciousness, and simply drawing from that information? You said yourself you don't know where that information came from.
Yeah, that's certainly a possibility. I would say that it's unlikely only because we haven't demonstrated that ever. Like, that's never been a scientific discovery that it could happen that way. But I mean, I'm a scientific skeptic. That doesn't mean that I'm a denier. I will acknowledge that things are possible, and that's certainly one of the possibilities. I hadn't thought about it in that scenario either, so thanks for bringing it up. But overall, I feel like me just thinking of random stuff makes more sense than something that's unproven. But if we proved that was a possibility, that somebody could connect into a memory or something like that, then I'd be more likely to look at it again and see if there's another possibility.
Well, is it safe to say, looking and kind of jumping here real quickly, and we'll come back to this, when it comes to claims of UFOs, is it safe to say the majority of them are most likely, these claims are not just misidentified craft, but the fact that they are actual craft that our country or another country possesses and is just secret governmental information that they don't want the rest of the world to really realize that this craft exists? Is that a pretty safe assumption? As opposed to aliens from an interdimensional portal?
That there's a lot of explanations like swamp gas and earthquake lights and stuff. But yeah, I'd say secret government craft are up there.
Okay, so we understand that the government has secrets from us, right? We understand that there is, in some cases, it's important to have those because we may need those secrets guarded so that in the event that North Korea gets wacky and pushes a button and starts launching missiles, we've got the technology to disband it and stop it before our people are hurt. And if
that would be the idea. I'm hoping that our government would be as capable as you make them sound. It doesn't look that way from the outside, but yeah, that would be the goal.
But my point is that the government has done a lot of research on psychic phenomena and, and you know, and my mind just went blank, which is a funny irony to this, what's it called when your visualization, you can see locations, a remote viewing. They've done this. We know that they've spent millions of dollars and years upon years on this, and even testing psychotic drugs and hallucinogenics to see if these open up. So we know that this exists. isn't it safe to say that maybe the reason science hasn't propelled in that realm is because we already have those answers, and it's not something that they want the public to have concrete evidence of?
I think if we had those answers, mm-hmm. then, first of all, these government programs wouldn't have been shut down. They wouldn't have been so wasteful. You mentioned
your judgment on it, right? I mean, I'm not going on the attack here, but it's easy to say they wouldn't have been shut down. Sure they would. Because if my job is to cure cancer and I find a cure for cancer, there's no reason to continue on more exploration.
Right.
I've cured cancer. If I've been able to prove telekinesis and telepathy exists and pyrokinesis and things like that, once I've proven it exists and we can remote view, we shut down those programs because there's no reason to continue to filter money to those programs, or at least not make them
right.
public. We now
but
take that information behind. I'm sorry?
We would have you would use those programs, you would use those people, you would find bin Laden a lot sooner than we did, for instance. We would have known where he was and gone in and got him immediately instead of waiting years and years and years and new president finds him. I mean, it just, the capabilities of our country don't equate to that of a psychic nation, in my opinion. If the psychic powers are real, I think that they weren't discovered by the government, and I'd be able to believe your experience with your mother and those two psychics more than the government, because they've shown again and again that they can't prevent things like simple attacks, that they can't go and get people like they could if they could remote view, you know?
Right. But then you're talking on the aspect of being able to apply to it every time. If you're unaware of the frequency of that message and not tuning in, and you're not looking for what is going to happen on September 11th, 2001. If you're not tuned into something like that, couldn't it just be possibly the message wasn't received because they weren't looking for that? It's like an interview. There are questions that after the interview is over, I always wish, oh man, why didn't I ask this? Why didn't I push a little harder there or go down this road? It could just be that was just a missed opportunity. And plausible deniability is a brilliant thing. And by acting the buffoon, right? I mean, it's the Columbo method, right? You have Peter Falk playing Detective Columbo, and he bumbles and stumbles through this, and he looks inept and he looks ridiculous and will play along and act like he's just as foolish as the criminals or the people involved in the story, but he's piecing it all together. I mean, it very well could be that the plausible deniability yep. is the government acting inept and stupid. And I'm not trying to give them more credit than they're do, but it very well could be, David, that they're a lot more in tune than we're giving. Yeah, they're a lot more in tune than we're giving them credit for, because if they act like they have all the answers, then they have to supply the answers. Whereas if they act like, oh, well, this is ridiculous, it keeps the rest of the countries maybe, you know, hey, look, they poured millions of dollars in and they found nothing, so we don't need to focus on this. We don't need to continue, you know, challenging this. And if you've got this kind of information available to you, I just think that it's easy to say this isn't repeatable in a scientific environment, yet there are colleges and universities around the world that did experiments like this, that did find that it was repeatable in some cases and that they were able to get these type of results. And then once they did that, suddenly their grants were shut down and their programs were shut down and it was taken into, you know, different aspects of investigation. Don't you find, and again, just jumping to the conspiracy bandwagon, isn't it fascinating that as they started to find repeatable subjects, it was, you know, their funding was pulled and they were shut down?
I would suggest that in many cases, just an example I'll use is a creationist guy recently started publishing paper after paper arguing that the Grand Canyon was created in one day by God and that it couldn't have been created by geological forces. And his science was bad, but his paper came to a positive conclusion, obviously. I mean, you're aware that papers can be bad and studies can be flawed and come to positive. And then his license was revoked, and he went on the offensive and said that it was part of some conspiracy to downplay creationism because they wanted to abide by evolutionary theory. And obviously, he got his license pulled because he did bad science. And I don't know the particular cases, but I know that I've seen this happen before where somebody publishes something that is flawed that we can find criticisms, valid criticisms with from both sides, and comes to a positive conclusion, and then they lose funding after that. I'd have to look into the particular instances you're talking about to judge if that's what happened, but that is something that does happen.
Right, but again, then who defines the generalization of what is bad science? We know that there has been remarkable work done in AIDS research and cancer research, and that some of this research has proven very effective in staving off and defeating cancer, yet our government will not progress with these cures or with this information. And, you know, there and this, again, this is scientific knowledge and journals that have appeared around the world from different countries and organizations that were able to kind of make that leap, and they found that these things work. And we won't accept that, yet we're continually putting into our food things that even third world nations refuse to take our food and our supplements from because it's dangerous in their eyes. And they've seen that, hey, our studies show this causes cancer, this causes problems, this causes memory loss or erectile dysfunction or whatever might be associated with that, you know, what's going on. So I think bad science, as you said, it's an issue in the fact of who defines what bad science is. You're a skeptic,
yeah,
and you've written multiple books on this, but I think it's fair to say, too, that you went in with a predisposed belief or non-belief in the subject that you're researching. So in a way, isn't that a flawed aspect to science? And isn't that bad science because you are already predisposed to believe this doesn't exist?
Well, it's actually really hard to say. With me specifically, I didn't go in as a disbeliever in all supernatural aspects. I tell in the story about an experience I have, two different experiences with what almost everyone I know would call ghosts. One is a memory I have from when I was very young, and I saw a family friend of mine. He was a little person, and he had fishing gear on. He was always fishing, and I saw him in my hallway, and that was about a week after he died. And I was so young. I was 8 or so. All I knew was this guy's name, you know. In retrospect, I feel like I probably made up that story, and I talk about that in the book, but I came to believe it because I told it so much. In my second experience, I was in college, and I woke up in the middle of the night to what everybody would decide as a ghost, a woman who looked like she was straight out of The Ring, who looked long, black, natty hair, dead face, drifting toward me in torn clothing, and I was paralyzed from fear, and I could not move at all, and all I saw was this woman coming toward me, and I was a believer in ghosts in that second. I did. And when I finally was able to shake myself out of my paralysis, I panicked. I looked online, and I Googled sleep, or I eventually came across sleep paralysis, which described how people can have sleeping hallucinations that basically creep into your waking life. Your body's confused whether you're asleep or awake. So your body falls asleep as completely paralyzed and your mind is still dreaming.
Right. The hypnagogic and hypnopompic states going in and out of sleep.
Exactly. So I fully believed that this woman was a ghost and that she was going to kill me until I researched further and found out. I also tell about my experiences with acupuncture and
But real quick, and we'll get into that in a second, but isn't it also that sometimes our minds want to fill in the blanks in order to make ourselves feel better? Because, David, it was an unsettling, uncomfortable, and terrifying moment to believe that there was a spirit in your room coming for you. It doesn't mean
it
that
was.
It's any less real than an actual experience of you getting up and going to have McDonald's after we get off this phone call, right? It was what it was. Couldn't it just be as easily said from the other side that it's easy to take the response of hypnagogic, hypnopompic states, sleep paralysis, and push this away? Because I don't really want that in my realm. I don't want to believe that there are ghosts and especially creepy ghosts that are hovering by my bed. You know, it's really easy to say to science, well, if you know, to say to believers in the paranormal world, then prove it to me. And it's easy to also say that, you know, science has made mistakes, a lot of mistakes in the past, in their assessments and generalizations of how things take place and why they take place. And to always, you know, throw the baby out with the bathwater, couldn't it just be said that it's a lot easier for David McAfee's mind to relate to hypnagogic and hypnopompic states and sleep paralysis? And let's just put it that way, so it's compartmentalized in a place where I feel a lot safer about what I just experienced, as opposed to maybe you did have that experience. Maybe you were coming out of sleep, and in that moment between consciousness and awake, you were alerted or aware of something that normally the brain would not pick up on.
Well, I think the scientific aspects of sleep paralysis are so well understood that it would be really difficult to make that argument because...
Well, for sleep paralysis, of course, but I'm talking about that realm in between, you know, consciousness and unconsciousness. Yeah. How do we know that that's not the realm where a lot of these things exist? I'm trying to find the right terminology here, but I mean, how do we know that that's not where we do have that moment in that brain state? We know how the brain works in different levels of sleep. Just because we have an understanding doesn't mean we understand exactly what those levels of sleep allow us to see or experience in what we would consider to be reality.
We know that people, when they're in those levels of sleep, see similar things that they do when they are asleep, that they dream. And we are aware that people have different experiences based on their beliefs. So I had a belief in ghosts, and I saw a ghost. I told you I had that experience when I was younger.
Right.
I was open to it. I saw this, and I believed it was a ghost. Other people, in fact, I think more people then would jump to the ghost hypothesis. They say that it's aliens abducting them, that they're being held down by aliens and that's the paralysis. Everyone interprets it differently based on their pre-existing conditions or ideas. But with these in between sleep and awake things, it's pretty clear scientifically that it is a result of hallucinations because it's different in everybody. It's not like this person is being abducted by aliens every night while somebody else is getting haunted by ghosts every night. It doesn't really make sense. It makes more sense to suggest the reality that they're dreaming and their body doesn't know that they're dreaming because that's why their body's asleep as well.
What about then you have people like Dr. Eben Alexander who understand how the brain and body works. As a doctor, they understand where these things went, but he is a firm believer that near-death experiences happen and that he truly did have an out-of-body conscious awareness during a near-death state. Then we're talking about science and the supernatural coming together.
Well, if he would prove that, that would be one thing, but right now it's just theory. And I talk about that in the book as well. And I do believe that out-of-body experiences happen, that people feel as though they're floating around their bodies. They have near-death experiences. I actually go really, really in-depth on those because it's a topic that fascinates me because we don't know exactly why we have them more precisely, we don't know exactly how we have them. And I talked to Michael Shermer in the book about that. But with near-death experiences, with his specifically, he's just telling the story and it sounds just like every other out-of-body experience. It's not that impressive. The impressive thing is that he's also a neurosurgeon and that's great. Ben Carson is a neurosurgeon and he believes that the pyramids were used to store grain. I mean, people are able to compartmentalize these things and he clearly has not applied the same scientific rigor to his personal anecdote as he has to other studied published papers because they're lacking the same evidentiary support. It's just his feelings. And I agree that he had those feelings. I agree that he had that experience. I agree with everything except for that it was a supernatural aspect and he hasn't proven that scientifically.
But in order to become approved, you have to pass through scientific journals and evaluations of your peers. And if those peers don't have a belief in that, how can you ever get the backing or support of your system when it's, again, kind of in the sense of it's already predetermined in their minds that this doesn't exist and that that's nothing more than anecdotal evidence, which is not, you know, that's not even admissible in court. You know, the right. Eyewitness reports are completely, you know, they're used often, but they can be easily dissembled and proven how faulty we are.
They're flawed. Yeah. And they're flawed. They're not counted as much for a reason. If personal experiences are flawed. People have feelings that they interpret as realities. They get tricked in the moment. Their memories change over time. what you see, what you think you see, is not always what you see, and that's pretty well established in science and in the legal system. And that's why his paper that I read isn't a scientific paper. It's just a story about what he felt, and that is not how we do these things. But there are people who look into, and he's not one of them, who look into afterlife, out-of-body experiences with such rigor that I enjoyed reading their papers and enjoyed the studies. And I don't know if you know about this one, but they actually ended up finding a positive result that they ended up claiming was a positive result in this published peer-reviewed scientific paper. What happened was the person was able to recount sounds of the machine that happened that they shouldn't have been able to recount while they were unconscious. But that wasn't part of the test that they set up. They were setting up cards on top of the cabinet, and they said, if you're out of your body, go to the top of the cabinet, read the card, and be able to tell us when you're done. Nobody could do it, but one person was able to recount the sounds that they heard. And that was impressive to me, although it didn't stick to the rigor of a scientific test.
Well, and see, to me, that's not impressive, because having been friends with people in the medical community for years, and especially people that are anesthesiologists and work in that field, many of them will tell you that the drugs, there are drugs, which is terrifying. They may give you three levels of drugs, one that's going to paralyze you so you're not flipping and flopping during surgery, one that will make you unconscious or put you in a state where you won't remember what's going on. And sometimes the concoctions don't work. The paralyzation might, but you're wide awake during the surgery and you're feeling everything. So that's not an exact science either. So the idea that people are conscious to a degree and they can hear machines and they know things, to me, that's a physical quality. So that actual aspect of this would not have impressed me at all. But there are, isn't it over in Oxford that they were doing the research on near-death experiences, and they would place things up in the ceiling tiles and on top of the roof and things like that, and people were coming back and reporting having seen those and giving details. What about those aspects in that research?
So I think we're referencing the same study, and I think if you look, people really, really misinterpreted that study, and I had to look into the actual results, because they said positive results based on this test where we put stuff in the ceiling tiles, and that ended up, the positive result was ended up being them being able to hear and describe the machines that were going around, and they counted that as the awareness that classified. I'm pretty sure it was at Oxford, the one I was talking about. So I want you to go into that actual study and look and see if it's the one, and I'll do the same, but I'm pretty sure that that's what we're talking about.
Yeah, I'd love to. I'll definitely do more research on that as well, and we can compare notes and maybe pick up on this part of the conversation again later. Is there any aspect of what the world considers supernatural that still intrigues you, that makes you believe that they're, you know, I mean, even Dr. Michael Shermer, and I love him. I think he's one of the best of the skeptic nation out there, because first of all, he's not condescending or demeaning when he comes to this. And although he may become flustered and frustrated that people seem easy to persuade one way or another, he's also very relatable and has made skepticism not a dirty word. You've got, you know, two ends of the spectrum. There's Joe Nickell, who's just, in my opinion, one of the most obnoxious pricks I've ever had the chance to talk to, because you're so much stupider than he is, and everybody's much stupider than he is. And Michael Shermer says, you know what, it's okay to sometimes just say, I don't know. That is weird. Dave, that's weird. When, you know, Dr. Shermer had experience, and we talked about that on one of our first episodes here on Beyond the Darkness, when he had the experience of his fiance's father's radio, which hadn't worked in years, switching on the day of their marriage and hearing these old time songs come through. He said, Dave, can I say it was a ghost? Can I say it's supernatural? No, but I can say I don't know what that was. And it's weird and it's fascinating, but it was an experience, and that's okay. To me, that's an interesting aspect of it. And I like to see that people that are skeptical to some of these aspects are still open to the idea. And we had Dr. Shermer on a show called Paranormal Challenge that I was a part of on the Travel Channel. And he was so great to work with, and watching him and behind the scenes, you know, he would often turn to me and Zach, the host of the show, and say, you guys are actually impressive. You're asking a lot more of the questions than I would have regarding what they thought they just experienced, and gave us credit for that. And there were a few moments when we had something happen and we'd all turn and look at him and I'd go, how do you explain that? And he goes, I cannot explain that. That was just, I'm just going to say that was weird. And it was great to have those kind of dialogues. But again, you know, it's the open discussion. And that's what I appreciated with you when we reached out to have you on the show. I said, you know, as long as you're not disrespectful to the fact that, you know, these are your beliefs and that's great. And we'll chat about them and we'll open up to this. But, you know, as long as you understand that the majority of the audience does believe in this, it doesn't mean I don't want you to show your side. And I love the fact that you're like, no, I'm respectful. I want to, you know, it is an important part of humanity is trying to understand these things and come together. And it sounds like you truly are open to the idea that you'd love to have an actual supernatural experience. But I'm curious, if you did, and you've had a few already that you've kind of dismissed from your reality, what would it take to make David McAfee believe something supernatural exists?
All right. So first, I'm very open to it in that I want these things to exist. I'm passionate about these things because they're so interesting. If we have an afterlife of any kind, then that's more than what we have here. And that would be incredible. If ghosts are real, that would be something else to explore, another realm to learn about. I would want to prove it scientifically so that we could start delving into it in a scientific manner. I don't mean like the scientific community or whatever. I mean the basic scientific method where you observe, you recreate, you watch, you take notes, you share with others. I want to do that with the supernatural if it does exist. I want to discover it. I talk about in the book if aliens came to me, what I would do, the first way to react to an alien visit, to take all the possible notes I can. I would tell the world. If I had an experience that I truly believed was supernatural, I would tell everybody. I would come on your show and be like, all right, let's do this together.
But after, okay, if you had the experience tomorrow, how long would it be before you would be willing to actually come forward and talk about it? Because I get the idea that you would then break down every aspect of what you just experienced, and it would take you 5 years before you would ever come forward to really truly say, this is the day I had the experience, and now I'm clear to say that I believe this is supernatural.
You know, with the rigor of scientific method, that's entirely possible. It could take a while, but I definitely wouldn't just have the experience and then declare myself a believer. I would have the experience. I would, if I couldn't explain it in any way, I would research it from every angle I could. I would talk to other people who've had that experience. I would talk to you. I would talk to everybody I know. And eventually, if I came to that conclusion, yeah, exactly, I would reach out at that point, and I would have a well-documented book on the topic to give everyone that day so that they can analyze it themselves and hopefully become believers.
I respect that. I respect that aspect of it. But I think the problem is with the scientific community, and I don't mean this is their problem, but I mean the problem with the supernatural, is that a lot of these are fleeting moments. They're, you know, missed opportunities. You didn't have your camera ready. You weren't ready. The excuse is always, we have high definition cameras on every phone now. There's no reason we shouldn't be getting better evidence. Yet I've been in positions when I've seen something, my first thought is not to whip out my camera. My first thought is I want to experience this whole thing. I don't want to move my eyes from what I'm watching. And you
that
have
to change.
It, well, it does, but it's also, isn't there that fear that, you know, hey, in taking this into a totally sexist kind of obnoxious way, if you're looking out the window and you happen to see through to your neighbor's house and, you know, the hot girl that lives there is about to remove her bra, are you going to look down and grab your phone real quick and try to catch a picture? Or are you going to watch so that there's not a chance you're going to miss what you might just see? You know what I mean? There's that aspect of us not wanting to turn away. It's why people have to look out the window and slow down at a car wreck. They want that perception. I mean, so that exists in all of us, that we want those moments. Just because it's not replicatable and because it's not always on demand, does that mean that it's any less real? Can't it just be that these things are happening around us, and sometimes our mental acuity is just not at a point where, you know, maybe your mind is relaxed, like those 3D pictures, you know, that looks like a bunch of zigzags. And the minute you look at them, Right. The minute you look at them and the minute that you, you know, let your mind relax is the minute that you're able to really see those things. It doesn't mean, and in that sense, it is replicatable because that image exists underneath that veil and you just have to train yourself to see it. But how do you train scientific equipment to see in something that we don't understand the spectrum of light that it exists in or what it's coming from?
Well, we do need to train ourselves. I agree with you that when you see something like an alien or a ghost or whatever you see and you want to enjoy it, I understand that. I have that same impulse. But if you want better evidence, if you want proof of these things, which it sounds like you do, then you're going to have to train yourself to work against that. You're going to have to go against your instincts. You're going to have to keep a phone with a camera on you at all times. I actually talk to a lot of people in my line of work. I end up talking to a lot of people who say that they're psychics who contact me online, and they're like, no, seriously, I can dream the future. And I'm like, okay, that's great. I don't disbelieve that you, I think you believe that, and it's entirely possible. But here's what I want you to do. And I tell them just to keep a dream journal. And every night when they wake up, write down everything that they can remember and try to match those to everyday events instead of going in retrospect, which is what everyone seems to do. They see something in real life and say, I dreamt about that last night. But the way that our brain makes connections, that might be a false connection. And so I just ask that they keep as much evidence as they can to try to prove themselves right, because that's going to be better for the supernatural paranormal community. You don't want to keep being the people that say, well, we need evidence of this. That's kind of the religious thing to do. That's just faith-based. If you want to prove what you want to do, if you want to prove what you believe in, then yeah, I would say train yourself against those instincts and try to come up with any evidence you can at all times for any situation that where it's possible. Obviously, it's not always going to be possible, of course.
All right, I know time is fleeting, and we've got about 10 minutes left here, and we've only barely scratched the surface of your book, and I appreciate the open dialogue you've shared with us today. But talk to me about some of the other points of the book that you really dig deeply into and that you found the most intriguing to research.
I talk a lot about faith healing in the book. I have a section on faith healing that people really seem to like, because I link types of faith healing that people don't normally link together, like exorcisms, traditional faith healing, homeopathy, things that are alternative medicine are in a way faith healing in that they utilize mostly placebo effect. Not that these things are all the same, obviously. Chiropractic has some helped some people for some things, for instance. But the way that I go into faith healing, and then ultimately I interview a woman from the Church of Christ Scientists. I don't know if you've ever heard of them, but they're a religion that believes that you can heal anything in the world and even cure dead people. You can resurrect dead people through the power of prayer. And she really believes that. And she said her sister's friend was resurrected from the dead through prayer. And it's just a really interesting experience to talk to her.
That's very intriguing. And again, there are aspects of that that I see glaring problems with, because if resurrection were possible, that would be happening on a regular basis. And trust me, when I lost my mom, I prayed like nobody's business to have her just open her eyes back up and be fine. And if anybody had the willpower to resurrect, that would have been the moment, but it didn't occur. So I understand that. But on the other side, I've seen the power of prayer and people coming together, setting an intention, and remarkable, amazing things happen, and medical issues seem to almost dissolve away in those moments. Do you reflect at all on that when you look at faith healing and belief?
Oh, there's a huge emotional aspect to healing. I don't think it's a psychic or supernatural aspect, but being in a positive mindset, having people around you, lots of people working together, chanting seems to help for some reason. Like, even just the rituals surrounding faith healing are helpful to people on a psychological level, which does help improve healing. There have been some studies that have shown that prayer actually worsened health. It was a cardiac arrest study that I reference in the book where a cardiac problem study where they study heart issues and prayed for half the people, and the people who didn't get prayed for did better. And their explanation was that the people who were prayed for
they did know about their prayers, and so that they were actually assuming that they would get better and then didn't and ended up crashing, whereas the people who didn't get any prayers just kind of went along, and it was a small negligible, like 2 to 2.5% better or worse. But that was an interesting study to me. So it can work both ways, but I'm definitely not one to refute the power of these things, despite my belief that they are coming from a natural place.
Interesting. The book will be out when? When does it officially get its release?
August 22nd.
August 22nd. You can go and pre-order it right now and take advantage of that. It's definitely a book worth reading. I've got a copy sitting here in front of me, and it's a fascinating read, a great study, and really interesting information, a great look into the mind of someone who questions, which is something we all need to do, and I've talked about that. I believe that the world needs more skeptics. We need to question the experiences and what's told to us from our leaders, from our scientists, from our believers and disbelievers alike. It's that questioning that continues the dialogue and continues the momentum of education and learning. Shutting down and cynicism are different, and thinking and believing you know all the answers is just as ridiculous as the people that believe that they're having these supernatural experiences. The whole idea of life is to experience and be open to the concepts and beliefs, and we wouldn't have progressed as far in science if we didn't press the envelope and try and charge forward. So it's great. And David, I appreciate your time, and hopefully you'll come back and spend more time with us here in the future.
Definitely. I'd love to. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. Hey, you guys, I don't know if you know this, but they've got a brand new, all new Podcast One app available in the App Store or on Google Play. You can find out everything about your favorite shows and get more content for my show, Beyond the Darkness. You can find articles, social media, episodes. You can also make playlists. It's easy to comment and connect with other show fans, and we have our own little community on there for Beyond the Darkness. You can share your favorite content, see behind-the-scenes photos, and in some of the shows, you can get 360-degree video or watch a bunch of shows in virtual reality. There's over 1,000 videos on there right now, and it looks like you're actually in the studio. It looks so cool, and there are so many things you can do, including fun things like rewards for listening. So check it out for yourself if you haven't downloaded the all-new Podcast One app. Make sure you take advantage of it. It's in the App Store and in the Google Play Store. That's it for today. We'll be back tomorrow with more of the best in paranormal talk radio. I'm Dave Schrader, and this is Beyond the Darkness.